Blog Talk Radio.
September, interesting month. Among the birthdays today is the last queen of Hawaii, Lilikuluani. She was queen from 1891 to 1893. And of course, we have the Hawaiian connection with Mr. Obama in the White House, who went to school over there and is connected to some of the things over there. Hawaii is very interesting. Captain Cook discovered it, but had the British colonized it, they might be flying the Union Jack. So that's where it is. And of course, they say the sun never sets on the British Empire. And a lot of former British, retired British military retire here in California and on the West Coast and in Hawaii. Also today, a birthday of Henry George, a social reformer of the late 1800s. Those of you who play, who are into athletics, baseball, golf, Albert Spalding was born today, and he started the Spalding Sporting Goods. And the governor of California, Hiram Johnson, was born in 1866, and he was a founder, or he was involved in the so-called Progressive Movement, which was the turn of the century, 1900, Teddy Roosevelt, Robert La Follette, George Norris, Fiorello LaGuardia. The problem with the Progressive Movement, it wasn't progressive when it came to the rights of ethnic minorities, such as Asians, Filipinos, Chinese, people who weren't Caucasian, and also Native American Indians. Little known fact about the so-called progressive movement, they did fight for fair elections, trying to get corruption out of politics, a direct election by the people for U.S. senators, tried to get better working conditions for poor people, but they were opposed to red light districts, prostitution. They wanted to keep the Indians on the reservations, and they wanted to restrict legal immigration of Asians into the United States. Now, the progressive movement, you'll hear that term used today, it's a verbal subterfuge. After World War II, the American Communist Party, or during World War II, they supported the fight against Hitler and Tojo and all of that. And, of course, Uncle Joe, Stalin the Butcher, the dictator, became Uncle Joe Stalin. But his intent to occupy as much of Western Europe as he could get the Soviet armies into and bring down the Iron Curtain, as Churchill would say, did say at Westminster College in Missouri, we began to realize that the communist Stalinism was a threat. And then we also saw Mao Zedong in Red China, what became Red China. And also on this day, Ho Chi Minh declared independence from France. Now, we'll get back to Ho Chi a little later. But what happened was the American Communist Party, which was founded in Chicago in 1919, this week, August, September of 1919. And what happened after World War II, we had the communist threat. The State Department was infiltrated. We had Alger Hiss, and he committed perjury. He was exposed. We had Elizabeth Bentley, Whittaker Chambers, all these people. The American Communist Party under Gus Hall went into the political closet and came out as, quote, progressives. They co-opted the political designation for the progressives of the 19th century. As I said, Hiram Johnson, Vera LaGuardia, George Norris, Robert La Follette, people like that. And so you will see today the Progressive Communist Party. You'll see their raggedy newspaper around, and that's what they're not progressive. They are really communist of the worst sort. And of course, there's a variety: the Stalinists, the Maoists, the Trotskyites, that whole bit. Also today is the birthday of one of the great opera singers, Heldentenor, Seth Svanholm. He was a rival to Lauritz Melchior. Seth was from Sweden, and he sang at the Metropolitan Opera many great Wagnerian roles. It takes a lot of stress, a lot of strain, a lot of training to become a Heldentenor, as they call it. Also today, interesting other birthdays, Cleveland Amory, the social writer. He was born today, and he was involved in society etiquette and all that sort of thing. Alan Drury, who wrote several books about politics. And we had Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of Attorney General John Mitchell in the Nixon administration. And she was on the phone until they shut her up, and she had this Southern accent, and she was yakking away, telling all. Until they cut the phone off on her. And, of course, her husband was one of the attorney generals of the United States who ended up in federal prison. We've had others along the way in the Harding administration, William Daugherty. Also today, another politician, Alan K. Simpson from Wyoming. His father was governor, and he was talking about something about his underwear, and he's on this so-called budget committee to reduce or eliminate the deficit. We had Joan Kennedy was the first wife of the late and in some many growing number of quarters unlamented Edward Kennedy, who's married several times, and they were supposed to be Roman Catholics, and of course he was divorced and remarried and buried in the Catholic Church. It was a very interesting contradiction there. The guy who made the 1984 Olympics a success, Peter Udidoff, was born today. And then one of the horrible tragedies in the space, our space program, when the Challenger, when it went up that day, and first time a woman was one of the astronauts, a school teacher, Krista McAuliffe. Krista was her middle name. She was born today in 1948. And this is one of the most interesting cases of a multi-ethnic. And one of the reasons why I personally reject this notion of hyphenated African American, Irish American, Spanish American, Jewish American. Keanu Reeves, the actor, was born today in Beirut, Lebanon. Now, his father was born in Hawaii, American citizen, native born, legally born, and his background, like a lot of Hawaiians, was multicultural, multi-ethnic. And he was, Keanu Reeves' father was English, Irish, and Chinese. Now, his mother, King Riyadh's mother, was English, and he carries a British, he is eligible for British citizenship, or a dual citizenship. Another thing I think we've got a problem with. Now, Reeves Jr. Went to school in Canada and later was a naturalized Canadian citizen, but his father was an American citizen because he was born in the United States. And so even though Keanu was born in Beirut, Lebanon, because his father was working there, if one of the parents is an American and one of the kids or a child is born abroad, then the citizenship goes with them. So I don't know what passport Keanu Reeves carries, but I don't think he's got all those multi-ethnic races on his passport, which would be English, Hawaiian, Chinese, Irish, it's ridiculous. So I would call him an American, even though he went to school in Canada and became a naturalized Canadian citizen. Incidentally, before the Canadian government cracked down on this practice, there were Americans who, before they were getting ready to retire and to be eligible and apply for American Social Security, they would get a Canadian Social Security number and qualify for Canadian Social Security. So they were getting two Social Securities cross-border until the Canadians objected finally and put an end to the practice. Among the other birthdays today, Jimmy Connors, who was known as the Brat, his mother taught him tennis, and he was a contemporary of the other Brat, McEnroe, John McEnroe. Jimmy married another tennis player, kind of cool cucumber, as they say. Among the deaths today, Hernan Cortez, who abused the Aztecs and defeated them and started the brutal colonization of South America. Baron Pierre de Coubertin, he's the founder of the modern Olympics. He died on this day. And of the events today, in the year 31, the Battle of Antium. That's when Mark Antony was in Egypt with Cleopatra, and he was their military leader. He was defeated on the sea by Octavian's naval forces. And Octavian, after he eliminated Mark Antony, committed suicide. He changed his name and became Augustus Caesar, the first of the major Caesars. Also on this day, getting back to the Olympics, one of the origins of the marathon dates back to 1490, when Sparta was fighting with the Persians, and Philippides ran from the battlefield to Sparta, I think, to convey the news, and he dropped dead. So that was the first marathon. And then jumping forward to 1666, we had the Great London Fire, which destroyed St. Paul's Cathedral, which was Christopher Wren, the great British architect. Excuse me. Still have my bit of my cold. And then in 1864, and there's some Daughters of the Confederacy still haven't forgiven General Sherman. General Sherman started the occupation and the destruction of Atlanta. A beautiful depiction of that is in the film Gone with the Wind with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh. Incidentally, Vivian Leigh was English. And then in 1901, jumping forward, we have Teddy Roosevelt, who coined the phrase, speak softly but carry a big stick. Now, T.R. also was, quote, a progressive, but he had very strange attitudes towards blacks and other ethnic minorities. And there was a notorious case of a black army unit in Brownsville, Texas, which was being harassed by the local rednecks, and there was some violence, and Teddy Roosevelt and his authority in his position of commander-in-chief of all the American forces, punished the black army unit and disbanded them. I think that's the correct word. And it's not a good credit to Teddy Roosevelt, and this is one of the problems. There was inherent racism in the progressive movement. And during the Russo-Japanese War, one of my favorite wars, because Admiral Radzinsky took the Black Sea Fleet 5,000 miles from Russia all the way around the Cape of Good Hope into the Sea of Japan at the Battle of Tsushima Straits, one of the greatest military naval feats in history, only to be defeated by Admiral Togo of the Japanese Navy. We'll get into more of that because it's a fascinating part of history. But Teddy Roosevelt played peace broker because he thought and said, he referred to the Chinese as the GD, dirty Chinese, and he referred to the Japanese as the plucky little Japs, but he didn't, since the Japanese were defeating the Russians, the Tsarist armies in Manchuria and Vladivostok, he decided to intervene and to broker a peace, which both parties, the Japanese and the Russians, met in, I think, New Hampshire, and brokered the peace treaty and stopped and ended the war. And for that, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. In fact, when he went to Norway, a piece of music was by one of the famous Halvorsen was composed for him. Welcome, Teddy Roosevelt, I think that's what it was called. And then, let's see, in the 1930, we had the first nonstop flight from Europe to the United States. So aviation was really taking flight, and this is what people like Charles Lindbergh, General Billy Mitchell, people like that, Juan Trippe, and Eddie Rickenbacker, all our early great aviators, this was their period. And then in 1936, we had the first transatlantic round-trip air flight. Then jumping forward to 1944, the famous Anne Frank case. Anne Frank was, she hid from the Nazis. Her whole family lived in a hidden compartment in an Amsterdam house and upstairs, and they were betrayed by a Nazi sympathizer. And the whole family was sent to Auschwitz. And the father survived. She kept a diary, and there's a famous movie, The Diary of Anne Frank. And her father survived and found the diary, and it became a book and then later a movie. And in 1945, Ho Chi Minh declared his independence, the independence of Vietnam from France, and then the Indo-Chinese War started. Now, Ho Chi Minh had studied as a chef. He worked as a chef in France, so he knew French very well, and, of course, the French influence. The French were the first major European power to go into the Orient or Asia. The Portuguese went there as traders, and they brought the priests there, but they didn't do, other than Macau and Goa, they didn't do the kind of colonization that the French did in Indochina and the British did in China, or tried to do in China. Also, on this day, in the Tokyo Bay, the USS Missouri, on board was MacArthur, General Wainwright, representatives of all the Allied, victorious Allied forces, military representatives. Japanese government signed the documents of surrender, and then that began the American occupation and remaking of Japan, and MacArthur's, as he saw it, there the image that he wanted Japan to present to the world. He did not break up the big combines like Mitsubishi, Mitsuishi, the companies that you see today, which make a lot of electronics, which they make in China and Malaysia. All the big cars we see, Toyota, Isuzu. In fact, Isuzu, which is not that well-known a name, they made tanks for the Japanese Army. But the big combines, he kept them together intact, and I guess his idea, MacArthur's idea was that they would help rebuild Japan. We had one of my father's relatives was connected to MacArthur. I think he worked for them or something. We didn't get the whole story. One of these days we will. And then in 1963, Governor George Wallace, who was a World War II veteran, he prevented the integration of Tuskegee High School. Tuskegee Institute was started by George Washington Carver, who had gone to the White House to try to get T.R. interested in integration. And he had dinner at the White House, but T.R. was not persuaded. George Wallace was interesting. He was poor white, And he wasn't the racist that a lot of northern media depicted him as. He was like a lot of poor whites in the South, that they weren't basically racist. They were just trying to survive, just like black people were. And Wallace ran his, when he ran his first election, in his own words, he said he got out-niggered. And he said he was never going to be out-niggered again. And so he went on this racist rant and later got shot and then saw the light of his astigmatic ways, let's put it that way. And later regretted that he had been, he went down that path of racism in the South. Then, this is interesting, this kid, Matthias Rust, he was 19 years old. He had about 50 hours of small plane flying training, and he decided to open up Russia, as it were. And so he was in Helsinki, Finland, and he said he was going to fly to Stockholm. Instead, he shut off his radio, and ground control could not contact him, and he headed for Moscow. He was going to land in the Kremlin, and had he done that, he would have been arrested by the NKVD, the Russian secret police, and it would have been the end of it. They would have denied that he was even there, because nobody would have seen it. However, he couldn't land there, and by a fluke, he landed in Red Square near St. Basil's Cathedral, and he was arrested, and he was sentenced to 4 years for hooliganism. That's what the Russians call that kind of activity. But he only served, I think it was about 14 months. He then went back to Germany. They expelled him, and he went back to Germany and did, national service, worked in a hospital, and he did something flaky, stabbed a woman. Then he became converted to Hinduism, married a woman, and then he got caught stealing and did a lot of flaky things. So I don't know what he's doing right now, but these people are really strange. And of course, he did inadvertently expose the Soviet air defenses, that they weren't as invulnerable as the Soviet general staff and the Minister of Defense had their fellow communists believe that they were invulnerable. And they had, a couple of years earlier, they had shot down Francis Gary Pollard and the U-2, and they were riding high because people realized that the Russians had these missiles that were capable of bringing down just about anything. But for some reason, they did not shoot down this small plane. That would have been interesting had they done that. So what happened was there was a major purge of the Russian upper echelon, air defense minister, all of that, all of those people. So, and then it is claimed that what Rush did was move Russia closer to getting rid of so-called communism and rapprochement, I think is the French word, with the West, with Gorbachev and that whole crowd. Now we're going to play the interview, the rest of the week, with Jack Phillips, who offers this advice. Now, he's got 50 years. He's retired now, and I didn't work with him, but I worked up there at KLW, a volunteer radio producer. I produced over 1,500 programs. In this interview, it's a rare one that you rarely hear from these people, especially with somebody with this type of background. He talks about the origin of television in Northern California. The electronics today are throwaway. We've moved from vacuum tubes, which you used to pull out and replace, to transistors and diodes and all of that. And if it's too expensive to fix it, you just throw it away and buy something else. He also offers advice to aspiring broadcasting students who hope they have a future and economic prospects, big bucks, in the broadcasting industry. It's all changing and has changed. Also, he talks about the introduction of personal politics and sexual preference in broadcast media. Leo Lee talked about that, and when I was at Western Public Radio, he used to say, you leave that S outside the door. You come in here to learn how to produce a radio program and not in here to push your personal politics or your agenda. And then we have the uniqueness of KLW-FM. It's the oldest FM station owned by a school district, and west of the Mississippi. And it goes back 70 years. It's the longest, it's lasted the longest, 70 years. A lot of school districts that had radio stations because of economics or lack of interest or whatever have canceled them or shut them down. But KLW, we'll get into this. Go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. You can see Jack Phillips with his magnificent name. It's AmiCusVeritas, and you can see the interview that I did earlier this year in 2011. But there's some more parts of this. Ted Samuel. It's probably the most unusual. It has the most unusual history of any radio station in Northern California. And Ted Samuel, who brought me in as a volunteer producer, and I lectured in the school district as a volunteer, was one of the first youths to cross the Golden Gate Bridge when it opened, or the first people to cross it. And he was at Fort Benning, Georgia, General Patton, across the river from Phoenix City, Alabama, which was the which used to prey on American servicemen, military servicemen that came over there looking for a little excitement, girls and prostitutes, and some booze and relief from the harsh discipline at the military base. And Ted never told me what he did. He was just 18 at that time, or very young. Then he was in Europe, and he was at he was in the Sixth Army. And, or Patton's Army, I think it was the 6th or 3rd. Anyway, he was a sergeant. He rose through the rank of sergeant. And he was at the railroad station where Russian POWs were being forcibly repatriated to Russia. And what Stalin did when these POWs, a lot of them did not want to go back because they knew the fate that awaited them, Siberia or torture and execution in the cellars of the Lubyanka prison in Moscow, which was the KGB, or NKVD as it was called. And what happened was the case of General Lazlov, which I'll get into in another broadcast. What happened was after the battle, the Germans who captured many Soviet troops, a lot of them were so fed up with the communist system that they wanted, he was Ukrainian, General Lazlov, and a lot of them resented Stalin's rule, and they know they weren't going to be treated well, and they weren't. And so the Nazis utilized this opportunity to turn these people, and they saw themselves as freedom fighters. The Nazis saw them as a useful ally to destroy Stalin. Well, what happened was they fought in Nazi uniforms against the Soviet armies, which they were formerly part of. And when they were captured at the end of the war, they were POWs, they knew the fate that awaited them when they were repatriated against their will to Russia. And many of them, Ted told me in an interview, unfortunately I lost the tape, that he was at the railroad station, and some of these guys were tried to hang themselves, slit their wrists, anything to avoid going back alive to Russia. So when those trains pulled into the Moscow marshaling yards, the terminal, some of them weren't terminated right away. The NKVD went on the train and started pulling off a lot of these people for torture in the Lubyanka prison. And eventually General Lazlov, horrible tortures were inflicted upon him, and eventually he was show trial, him and some others, and then he was hanged, and all the pictures are there, and we'll show those. And this was Ted's experience in World War II. He also, I think he was at Mauthausen and helped free that camp, the Nazi concentration camp in Austria. So let me get that interview with Jack Phillips. It's about 20-some minutes. And let me, I just moved it up. Where is Jack? Where is Jack? Sorry about that. Here we go. Here we go. Where is Jack? Oh, sorry about that, guys. It's this new system. I still haven't quite got it down. And just trying to get it. I may have to take some of these off. But I had him up here. Jack, where are you? it's a great interview and good advice for anybody. If you know anybody, this will be up in the archives, and you can access it. I think you can download it also. Where is Jack? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to get this system down. This new system. It's coming up, folks. I'm sorry about this. Come on. I wish we had the other system. I don't like this. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. Where is Jack Phillips? Oh, damn it. Sorry about that. It'll be just in a minute. Oh, it's Jack Kuriak. No, you don't want that today. I've got about 40 here, and we're going through them, unfortunately. How much to go? We don't want that. Oh, I'm sorry, folks. That should be at the top. Here we go.
Let me just make sure I got the volume here. Oh, you look great, Jack. Let me just make sure I got the volume here.
The TV industry started right after World War II, late 40s. First channel on the air was KPIX.
That's San Francisco. Was it owned by CBS?
I don't remember who owned them. I think it might very well have been. It was CBS as far back as I can remember. And they had their transmitter on top of and some studios in the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And a lot of the TV stations staffed them with people that were working for them, the radio stations that they also owned. For instance, CBS had a radio station, and
KCBS,
yeah. And NBC had a radio station, and
KGL, Westinghouse, Channel 7.
Channel 7 was
ABC.
KGO, yeah, mm-hmm. ABC. And their original staff was people that moved into TV from radio because the people that were available, that was it. There wasn't any TV people really available. Particularly on the technical side, TV was a whole new industry. And at that time, the whole world, the whole technical world, required a lot of maintenance because it was all vacuum tubes. The vacuum tubes are like light globes. They have a finite life. They burn out after a few hundred or a couple of thousand hours. And so they needed technical staff. And I had worked as a technician first in the coin machine business and then some other things, and ultimately worked in TV. And KALW was part of the TV training program at the O'Connell School in San Francisco, and it was partially funded by MDTA. That was Manpower Development and Training Act that was federally put together from World War II. And I went to work there in 1966 in the electronics department. And if a student came in that wanted to be an electronic technician, he was almost guaranteed a job because there just weren't enough of those guys. And some of the equipment that the TV stations had at the end of the 50s and in the early 60s was very complex for its day and required a lot of maintenance. A videotape machine was in use in the broadcast trade before we even knew tape for audio existed. And the things were, the machines were very complex and very troublesome.
Chad, some people prefer vacuum tubes, like the old Macintosh amplifiers and that. Are they superior to the new development?
It's a
choice?
Finish.
Ah.
Okay. And, you know, they work, and they work well. They're beautiful amplifiers, but you can get a better amplifier today for a lot less money. The interesting thing about it is that most of the distortion in an audio system at the low frequency end is generated by the loudspeakers. Nobody seems to ever talk about it.
Mm.
Okay.
So like the subwoofers?
That's where the
distortion is.
Low frequency, the subwoofer.
Could you offset that with a frequency machine equalizer?
No. It has to do with the physical size of the parts in a loudspeaker. There's a saying in the trade that says you can't get big sound out of a small box. And for big, low-frequency sound, you need big loudspeakers and big amplifiers. Mm. But anyway, back to the O'Connell School. In the O'Connell School, there was an electronics department, and there were four or five of us on the third floor, and on the fifth floor, there was KALW, and one man, Ken Nielsen, and he had been there for a lot of years when I went there, and he was approaching retirement. KALW radio was on the air a few hours a day. There was not the demand for and the desire for and the money for a radio station that there is today. And so KALW first went on the air right after World War II and back in the 50s, late 40s, and it had been in the works for a long time. I don't know how long.
Hmm. What was the first school district-owned station west of the Mississippi?
It was the first district-owned station. And as I said, was on the air for, they'd turn it on and run it for a couple of hours to train people what to do in a radio station from the technical end, and they also learned a little about how to sit in front of a microphone. In 1970, give or take a couple of years, I'm going to say 69, maybe 70, 71, somewhere in there. The demand for band space, bandwidth, room for another radio station began to increase for FM. It had already been there for AM, and the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, had pretty good control over AM radio, and it was necessary if you were in AM radio, in order to be there, you had to be there, so to speak. And there were a lot of stations that were on the air 24 hours a day. We could run, for training purposes, we could run an FM station and turn it on once a week, shut it down for the summer vacation. And then the Federal Communications Commissions came in and said that you're going to lose your license because there are people that want it. And so we realized that it was a case of either use it or lose it. And so we had to upgrade KALW from a part-time training school to a full-time, on-the-air, 14, 15 hours a day, maybe 18 hours a day, I don't remember which. And Ken Nielsen, that had been teaching the program, was moved to manager of the radio station. Shortly thereafter, Ted Samuel and Leon Del Grande came in as a program director, and so on and so forth. Ken became the chief engineer, and I took over the training part of it, and that would have been early 1970s. I was there for 20 some odd years before I retired. I don't remember any exact dates, so these dates are loose. At the time I left, the industry was in a big dip. It was entirely different than it was when I first started. I had people calling me from all over the country saying, I understand you have a training program for technicians, and you could put them anywhere they wanted to go. I think there was two or three of them over that time went to work for CBS New York. And at one time, a good portion of the people working in the technical end of the broadcast business were people that I had been involved in the training with. Then in late 70s, that began to change, because the videotape machine that I mentioned earlier had moved up. It was less troublesome. You didn't have to have a technician there to hold its hand all day. Today, videotape is a thing of the past. We have little disc recorders, or in some cases, full solid-state big chips that will store program material. Relatively trouble-free, and where you, if you were a major market station like any of those here in San Francisco during the 60s and early 70s, you had to have a technician on hand 24 hours a day.
We've been asked to replay this on Labor Day, which is Monday, so we will, in its entirety. So this is Peter Paul Vizzola, and we will be back on Monday at 5 o'clock. Have a good, safe weekend. Good night.